This is Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal for July 28, 2005, with Amy Brown and Meredith DeFrancesco. Congress today passed a multi-billion dollar energy bill that has Texas Republican written all over it. Matt Prindeville of the Natural Resources Council of Maine will join us in a few minutes to give us their analysis. And later in the program, we'll hear from Steve Burke of Let Cuba Live, with an update on the latest shipment of humanitarian aid to Cuba, some of which has been seized at the Texas border. And joining us now is Matt Prindeville of the Natural Resources Council of Maine. Welcome, Matt.
Hey, Amy. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Your job includes analyzing these types of bills, different legislation for the Natural Resources Council of Maine. This is a really, I think the New York Times called it a massive energy bill. There are a lot of components to it. So in the time we have, why don't you hit on some of the major points and let us know what some of the more serious concerns that your group has with this one?
Sure, Amy. Yeah, essentially this is really just an energy bill in name only. I mean, it does nothing to move us towards a forward-thinking energy policy for the future. There's really little to nothing in the bill to make us less dependent on foreign oil and more energy independent. I mean, essentially, the final energy bill that passed at a conference promotes 19th century responses for 21st century problems.
How so?
It's a collection largely of wasteful subsidies, missed opportunities, and anti-environmental policies. I mean, it gives billions of dollars in tax breaks to mature and highly profitable industries, oil, gas, coal, while incentivizing the construction of more coal-fired power plants. And especially for those of us here in Maine that live downwind of the nation's prevailing wind air patterns, it's especially a problem, especially for the ever-increasing number of Mainers who suffer from asthma. It also provides incentives for increased drilling on public lands. There's the potential that through this energy bill, there's the potential for oil and natural gas exploration out off of Georgia's Bank and potentially in the Gulf of Maine. It also includes huge subsidies for highly profitable oil companies, oil and gas companies. I mean, ExxonMobil is expected to announce some of the highest record profits that's ever been seen on the oil markets today, while doing nothing to reduce dependence on imported oil or mitigate global warming or air pollution.
And this bill, the estimate is that the bill, the cost to taxpayers is in the range at least of $10 to $12 billion. However, the Taxpayers for Common Sense group, according to the New York Times, has said that their analysis shows that there's potentially $80 billion in spending on the bill. So this is quite expensive.
I mean, the $10 to $12 billion, it's actually a $14 billion, and that's a tax incentive package. Those are the tax breaks that are given for oil and gas exploration. There are some good components of the bill as well, but the $14 billion that you're referring to have to do with tax incentives and subsidies for energy corporations. The $80 billion is what potentially it could cost the government for everything that's included in the energy bill, all of the restructuring of the electrical grid, there's a considerable more amount. But let me just speak a little bit about the $14 billion in tax incentives. The vast majority of that is going for for domestic oil, natural gas, and coal exploration, as well as to incentivize the building of more coal, oil, and natural gas-fired power plants. However, they've expanded the renewable production tax credit, and what that does is it allows renewable energy sources like wind, biomass, certain forms of hydropower, some solar power, to get a 1.9 cent per kilowatt hour tax credit towards energy production. This is something that's been, there's the Mars Hill project in northern Maine, which had been put on hold, which is essentially waiting for this tax credit to pass. So there is some money for alternative fuels technology. There's about $1 billion in incentives for increasing energy efficiency in our nation's buildings. But the vast majority of that $14 billion, as well as the vast majority of money that's going, the $80 billion that was suggested by the American Taxpayers Association, you know, that is going largely to the big energy corporations.
And so some pieces of it were included in order to get enough support to pass it. However, conservation groups are also concerned that there are many other things that were left out, pieces that were cut or things that were never included in the bill to start with. Why don't you talk about some of those things that you're...
Yeah, those are the really important pieces, Amy. I mean, first of all, this bill does nothing to address fuel efficiency standards for cars. That's been frozen for 3 decades. And the last time that we had an increase in fuel efficiency for automobiles was during the Reagan administration. During the Carter administration. We're talking about the major pillar for a national energy policy, which has been completely ignored. There was a provision in the Senate energy bill, the Senate version of the bill, to reduce annual oil consumption by 1 million barrels by 2020. Now, that's an extremely modest provision, and that was stripped out. Just to put that in perspective, today we import around 21 million barrels of oil a day. So to reduce, our oil consumption by, that's today, that's not 2020. So to reduce our oil consumption by 1 million barrels a day by 2020 would have put a teeny dent in the amount of oil that we import each year. Another provision was a standard to get a renewable portfolio standard of 10% by 2020. What that means is that it would have been a mandate for utility companies to produce 10% of the electricity generated in the country from renewable sources like wind and solar and biomass and whatnot. That provision was stripped out. To put that into perspective, you have Germany, which is pledging to do 20% of their energy from renewable sources this year. So that's, again, putting 10%, by 2020. Even that modest provision was stripped out of the bill. A real national energy policy really should be focused on two things. I mean, cleaning up our national energy supply, investing in renewable energy, having greater energy efficiency in buildings, and stopping the gas guzzling. We need more fuel efficient automobiles. We've got the technology to do it. The people want it. I mean, in every poll that we've seen at the Natural Resources Council, Americans overwhelmingly support the increased use of renewable energy and increased fuel efficiency for cars. But the Bush administration and their friends in Congress are dragging their feet as deep and as hard for as long as they possibly can.
Well, speaking of the Bush administration's friends in Congress, Joe Barton, the Texas Republican representative who's the chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee, was quoted in the New York Times as saying, "This is a darn good bill and it's going to help this country, and the sooner we get it done, the better." He also acknowledged that they dropped a plan to provide legal immunity entirely to manufacturers of MTBE, but there's a sort of a back door to that. Do you want to say a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'm laughing about Joe Barton being quoted in the New York Times, because here's a man, he and Tom DeLay, both representatives from Texas, both with an extremely large amount of power in Congress, have basically, were working to secure Amoco, which is a major contributor to both of their campaigns, from having to pay any liability. The estimates are somewhere in the range of $30 billion for liability from groundwater contamination from MTBE, which, as many of your listeners know, has been added to gasoline, supposedly to make it burn cleaner. The problem is that it pollutes groundwater, and it's a carcinogen. And, Amoco has known about this for a long time, and Representative DeLay and Representative Barton wanted to shield a corporation which gives them a large amount of money for their campaigns from having to pay out liability. And essentially, that was the major thing that held up the energy bill for so long. Now that it's been removed, in all likelihood, it's passed the House today, and in all likelihood, it'll pass the Senate tomorrow. I'm hoping that our main senators will throw out a vote of conscience and vote against this bill, but it's hard to see if that's going to happen. The backdoor immunity clause that you were talking about is a sneaky clause that was put in. Essentially, it transfers oversight on MTBE claims from state courts to federal courts. So if I went on any case that has to do with state tort law, nuisance law, or consumer law, so if I'm a, you know, if I'm a neighborhood association and we've had our, or a municipal water district and we've had our groundwater or our wells or our city municipal water system contaminated by MTBE pollution, then we can't sue in our own home state courts here. We have to go to the federal district court in order to be heard. Again, providing backdoor immunity because the state regulations in some cases could be more stringent or more tough than federal regulations.
And this may be going slightly outside of your area here, but do you have any thoughts about whether that would make any laws if the federal government even did try to pass any, make any protections around MTBE more susceptible to being challenged by the so-called free trade agreements if they're federal government?
Unfortunately, that is out of my expertise, Amy.
Okay, we'll ask. Although I was
sad to see that CAFTA passed the House, but that is outside of my expertise.
Okay, all kinds of news today. Another piece that was left out in order to get this to pass was drilling in the Alaskan Wildlife Refuge. Although Pete Domenici of Republican of New Mexico, who's the chairman of the Energy and Natural Resources Committees, says that he will definitely try to win that battle later this year in a budget measure that's not open to filibuster. So that's only been maybe slightly delayed. Can you say a little bit about that?
Yeah, that's exactly right, Amy. I mean, they kept the that provision out of the energy bill to allow it to pass, but they've done something that's extremely sneaky, and that was that Republican leadership was able to not explicitly but implicitly include it in the federal budget, which passed and is now in conference committee. So the way that this works is the federal budget, the Bush administration has instructed, each of the committees, like the Energy and Commerce Committee and the Environment and Public Works Committee, they have to trim a certain amount of dollars out of the part of the budget that they oversee. So what that means is that the Energy and Commerce Committee, which Pete Domenici is the chair of, they've been instructed to trim $2.6 billion off of the part of the federal budget that committee oversees. And so the way that they're making up the difference is by $2.6 billion is a lot of money. And what they're planning to do, it's an inflated figure, so it allows for Domenici to make up that difference by including leasing revenues from drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And that's going to be a big fight. Senators Snow and Collins have repeatedly opposed drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, even though they both voted for this budget when they knew that implicitly this could happen. But the interesting thing, the reason why Republican leadership decided to put the to try to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge this way is because when they tried to do it before, they couldn't overcome a filibuster in the Senate. Again, you need 60 votes to make a piece of legislation filibuster proof. The reason that it's been included in the budget is that all budget related bills need a simple majority to pass. They're essentially filibuster proof. So the Democrats and concerned moderate Republicans that don't want to drill in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge will probably not be able to mount They would have been able to mount a filibuster had it been voted on up or down, as it has been in the past. But in this case, now that it's in the budget and all that requires is a simple majority to pass, it's not going to be the case. So there's a whole bunch of groups that, you know, we're really working on Senator Snow and Senator Collins to do everything that they can using their leadership positions to make sure that Arctic drilling is not included in the budget that comes out of conference committee.
Okay.
And if it is, for them to vote against it.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about this energy bill, but just as people are listening and we're talking about contacting the senators or other action that people may want to take, or we'll have you at the end give information, contact information, and whatever other numbers, phone numbers, or email addresses that you think people should use if they want to get more information or contact someone.
Right.
One of the other things about the energy bill is that it repeals the Public Utility Holding Company Act.
Yes.
And so that's which has in the past limited utility mergers.
Right. You know, as I understand it, again, I just read about this the other day. I mean, there's so many pieces of this bill that are coming to light now that it's actually out of conference, and they've dropped certain provisions and picked up some. There were also a whole bunch of amendments that were included as it was in conference, and some of the things I'm just getting up to speed on. But what you're talking about does exactly that. I mean, it essentially is an obstacle for utility companies to have oligopoly or monopoly control over regional and national electrical systems, and that's what I understand of it now. This is essentially, you know, making it easier for large corporations, energy corporations, to merge and have more control over energy markets.
You can see why this is something that the Republicans are really happy about. Another piece that's going to have possibly a huge impact here in Maine is the piece about federal powers over siting of liquefied natural gas facilities.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, essentially what that provision does is it allows for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, it allows for federal regulators to trump the concerns of local and state governments in siting for LNG facilities. So what's in the energy bill is streamlining the processes for energy corporations to get what they want. There's a reason why some of these regulations make it cumbersome for energy corporations to get what they want, and that's because the government's job is to balance the interests of the public, you know, with the concerns of private industry. And what the streamlining processes do is essentially whenever you hear about, you know, attempts to make government more efficient, you've oftentimes got to read between the lines and more friendly to business. Oftentimes what that means is that you're stripping out public comment periods, you know, you're stripping out the ability of the public to have a decision and to have a say in decisions that affect them at the local level. And this is the case of Republicans will say that they're for state rights when it's convenient for them. But when it comes down to the siting of liquefied natural gas terminals, again, this is another case where, you know, big business rules all, and the government is going to not get in the way of the siting, but instead is going to facilitate, big business, specifically the liquefied natural gas developers, from siting the projects wherever it is most convenient to them.
So if anybody's just joining us, we're talking with Matt Prindeville of the Natural Resources Council of Maine. His job includes helping analyze bills for the NRCM, and the one that we're talking about now is a massive energy bill, and it passed in Congress today. What happens next?
It passed in the House today.
In the House, I mean, right?
And it's most likely going to pass the Senate tomorrow. What you say? What happens now? I mean, that is, you know, the real question is, you know, how do we change the direction of America's energy policy? I mean, it happens that we actually begin reducing dependence on foreign oil and that we're actually starting to mitigate global warming pollution and air pollution. You know, how do we begin moving towards, you know, a smarter, cleaner energy policy that reduces dependence on foreign oil and on these polluting energy sources and that significantly increases energy efficiency, renewable energy, and protects public lands and, you know, saves consumers money? I mean, this is, you know, this is what energy policy should look like. It's supposed to be about you know what are some 21st century solutions to 21st century problems. I mean, as I stated before, we've got the technology to clean and green up our energy sources. We have the technology to have cars go much further on a gallon of gasoline than they do today. You know, we've got the technology. I mean, this is. You know, this kind of energy policy would be great for America's economy. It would be great for American jobs. It would be great for national security. I mean, it would be great for anybody that likes to breathe, you know? Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, you know, the Bush administration and the House of Representatives and probably tomorrow the Senate will have sold our country short, in that they are looking out for the interests of major energy corporations over the interests of the American people.
Right, and so you have some hope that there's some steps that people can take and some way to turn this around, although there's not any doubt that this is going to be signed by Bush.
Right. I mean, what we're really looking to, Amy, is the future, and you know, we're really looking, you know, to I mean, you know, Europe is really leading the way with advancing you know, an energy policy that is forward thinking. I mean, the European Union has established a goal of having all of their energy needs met through renewable energy and hydrogen energy by the year 2050. You know, we've set out nothing anywhere near as ambitious as that. You know, we've essentially rolled the clock backwards with the passage of this energy bill, and you know, it's essentially more of the same polluting. You know, I mean, you know, we're at war right now, partly because of energy resources. And you know, this, you know, as I've said before, I think this is, you know, a backwards thinking energy policy and a backwards way to meet our nation's energy needs.
What can people do now? What's are there any specific actions that you, if anybody is concerned about this, that they can take?
Well, you know, at this point today, the first thing you can do is to go to www.maineenvironment.org, and that's our website, and you can get Senator Snow and Senator Collins' contact information off of there. Urge them to vote no on this bill tomorrow. You know, it, like I said, in all likelihood, it probably will pass. But you know, for our senators to vote their conscience and even possibly to stall this energy bill one more time, as they have twice in the past, would be excellent. And you know, the second thing you know that you can do is to stay informed. You know, stay informed about energy issues, and you know, use your power as a citizen to vote in people who are really advancing, you know, a forward thinking energy future. And thirdly, you know, use your power as a consumer. I mean, this is probably the most power that citizens have in this country right now over our nation's energy policy, is to use your power as a consumer. You know, buy fuel efficient automobiles. The next time you're going out to buy a new car, you know, go try to buy a hybrid car, or at least buy a fuel efficient, low polluting car. They're all over the place in the market today, and there's only going to be more of them out there. You know, insulate your home. You know, the state of Maine offers they have a grant program. You can go to the maine.gov and look in I'm trying to remember, I think it's the Public Utilities Commission. You know, you can look at that part of the website, and they have a grant program for folks to provide money for folks all over the state to winterize and weatherize your home, so that you're gonna save money, you're gonna save on fuel costs, and you're gonna do something great for the environment. Next time you go out to buy a new appliance, you know, make sure it's got the Energy Star seal on it. Next time you're going out to buy a new refrigerator or a new microwave or a new TV set, you know, make sure that it's an energy efficient appliance and that it's going to be saving energy and at the same time saving you money.
Matt, we're running out of time, unfortunately, but I think what we can do is have people get in touch with you by email for more of these ideas, because you're on a roll with some suggestions here, and I hate to cut you off. So how can people contact you for more information?
You can contact me. It's real easy. www.maineenvironment.org. And, my number, if you want to call me at the council, is 207-622-3101, extension 244. I'd be happy to talk to you. We have a whole wealth of staff with a whole bunch of knowledge on pretty much any environmental issue that concerns us here in Maine, and we'd be happy to talk with you and certainly sign you up as activists, because we need more and more people to be active on these issues and to contact their elected officials and voice their concerns about the way that our nation is going and that our state is going with regards to environmental matters.
That's Matt Prendeville. Thank you very much for joining us today, Matt.
Thanks, Amy. It's been great talking with you. I'm a big fan of the show.
Thank you.
Yep.
And next we are joined by Steve Burke of Let Cuba Live. Welcome, Steve. Steve?
Hello.
Hi, Steve. There you are. Steve, you're going to give us an update on the latest Pastors for Peace humanitarian aid mission. More than 100 people, about 130 U.S. citizens are in this latest humanitarian mission to bring aid to Cuba. And from what we understand, they made it across the border last week, but without some of the equipment that they were bringing. So why don't you tell us a little bit more about this mission and also what the latest news is about it.
Okay, Amy. Among those 130 people were two folks, members of Let Cuba Live from Maine, Jill Abernathy, who's a social worker in Rockland, Maine, and Todd Ricker, who's a union organizer from the Portland area. Both of these people are in Cuba today. As far as the shipment itself went, it carried almost 140 tons of humanitarian aid, and they travel by caravan and school buses and trucks and cars. And the caravan rolled up to the border on Thursday morning. In the past, we've been met by officials from the Treasury Department and the Office of Foreign Assets Control, which is a division of the Treasury Department that's charged with the enforcement of the U.S. blockade against Cuba. Things were different when the 16th caravan rolled up to the border on Thursday. They were met by Commerce Department officials and 45 officers from the Department of Homeland Security, in addition to Treasury officials and U.S. Customs agents. And the entire shipment was detained for most of the day on Thursday. And at the point that the Department of Homeland Security began to tear into the carefully manifested shipment and scatter things around and threaten to tow the buses away and impound everything, Pastors for Peace activated their emergency response network, and people all over the country, Cuba Solidarity Groups, activated their email lists, and calls began to pour into congressional offices around the country, and calls began to pour into the border.
Steve, we have 1 minute.
Sure.
No, go ahead. I'm sorry. I just want to let you know we have just 1 minute left. Unfortunately, we're running behind on time.
Okay, I'm sorry. I'll give a wrap up in 1 minute as much as I can. But the government has seized 7 boxes of humanitarian aid, mostly computers, peripheral stuff, and things like that. So we're organizing to try to secure the release of these boxes, and we're encouraging people to call the Department of Commerce. There's a dude there named Carlos Gutierrez. He's actually Secretary of the Department of Commerce, and his phone number is...
But you can call him dude.
Yeah. He's 202-225-3121. Tell him to give Pastors for Peace back their computers and let the French shipment proceed, the rest of the French shipment proceed unimpeded across the border.
Great. Thank you, Steve Burke. Sorry we ran short on time.
That's okay, Amy.
That's Steve Burke of Let Cuba Live, and you've been listening to Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal. I'm Amy Brown. Meredith DeFrancesco is away this week. Joel Mann engineered today's program. Andy Buckley does web and technical support. You can reach us here at WERU or by emailing radioactive@mainindymedia.org. Our website is radioactivenews.org, and it has been updated, and we are now podcasting as well. Thanks for listening and acting. Stay tuned for more independent news on your community radio station, WERU, and join us again next Thursday at 4 for Radioactive. Radioactive is made possible in part by Artisan Builders, providing environmental design, construction, and renovation for homeowners and local businesses since 1992. 525-7740.